Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant with American Giant. They aren't affected by tariffs because their clothing products never left the U.S. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
I welcome Paul Mueller, Senior Research Fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research, graduated PhD at George Mason University, taught at King's College in New York, now writing for Civitas Outlook at Civitas Institute about free trade, about industrial policy. Here we are in the 21st century, and industrial policy is an artifact of the 20th and the 19th and the 18th. However, it is in question again because of the competition with large export-only nations. I could mention the People's Republic of China, used to mention Germany. And those export nations have industrial policies, if I read them correctly. And is that something that's desirable? Does that accelerate past the system that the U.S. endeavors to call free trade? All of this is attended to by Mr. Mueller, Professor Mueller, in reviewing a new book that has recommendations for industrial policy. And the reason this book is important is because not only is it very long and written in for experts, economists, but it has a recommendation in the title, Industrial Policy for the United States, Winning the Competition for Good Jobs and High-Value Industries, by Mark Fastenow and Ian Fletcher. Paul, a very good evening to you. This strikes me as something that is very aggressive. What is your measure of this book now? Is it in the marketplace for some time, so they're summarizing for those of amateurs on the outside? Or is this a new wave in economics? Good evening to you.
Well, thank you for having me, John. I appreciate it. This book, it's an impressive book. I mean, the authors have done their homework. It's wide-ranging. It goes in depth. It offers a number of provocative arguments. At least as a free market economist, I find them provocative. And I think it's going to be around for a while, and it's worth studying just to think through serious challenges to what some call the neoliberal consensus or classical liberal views on free trade and free markets. I find it ultimately unpersuasive in a number of regards, but it's an important book and it's a book for our moment. And I think that it will likely get a lot of traction among policymakers in D.C. who have begun to play around with industrial policy. Again, we're seeing a resurgence politically of this. You know, on the left, there was always this element. On the right, this was sort of downplayed in the years of Reagan and Thatcher into the 90s and 2000s. But this desire to fix the economy, to direct the economy, to create a certain kind of economy that policymakers think is best, that impulse is back, and we're seeing some of the fruits of that in the U.S. today.
You've done us the great favor of quoting Adam Smith in your essay, which I found after reading some of the arguments by the authors and the idea of industrial policy. It was very helpful to go back to the beginning of Adam Smith's observations. I read in part, "The statesman who should attempt to direct private people in what manner they ought to employ their capitals would not only load himself with a most unnecessary attention, but assume an authority which could safely be trusted to no single person whatever, and which would nowhere be so dangerous as in the hands of a man who had folly and presumption enough to fancy himself fit to exercise it." Wonderful, wonderful roundabout way of saying, okay, show me the example and I'll show you the failure. Paul, let's go to what we have right now for industrial policy arguments, not the super planning of rebuilding an economy after a war, that was Germany and Japan, nor building an economy from the scratch of agricultural centuries, that was the People's Republic of China. And still, I understand there are 300 million people in China who live in that kind of poverty today. Let's talk about what we do in the United States, a heavily industrial and successful company. The news most recently, NVIDIA, the most valuable country on earth, and approaching $4.5 trillion, agreeing first to share profits in some fashion with the United States government, and second, to invest in companies that are part of the plan of the Trump administration to fix microchip manufacturing in the United States in our borders and not have to depend upon the vulnerable Taiwan. Does that qualify as industrial policy, or is that fancy around the edges?
It's certainly related, for sure, and the desire to reshore various kinds of industries, chip manufacturing and others, is part of this industrial policy. I think part of the draw of industrial policy today is that it's conflated with other things that are good and important. So part of why I think the Trump administration's sort of aggressive industrial policy has been embraced in many ways is because in other regards, the Trump administration is very pro-business. In contrast to the previous administration, they want to pull fossil fuels out of the ground. They want to increase electricity generation. They want to engage in mining. They want to build things. And those, I think, are all good impulses. And they have passed tax reform to spur growth. They have deregulated like crazy to spur growth. And they argue this industrial policy, whether it's NVIDIA or taking a stake in Intel or, you know, setting up these quote unquote sovereign wealth funds that the administration is going to direct. They argue that that's part of this sort of pro-business, pro-market agenda. And I think that is a mistake, one that's easy to make when they gloss over the differences and misunderstand how markets allocate resources and how they discipline firms, how they reward innovation and productivity. But I think that's why they are having so much success so far, relatively little resistance, is because their industrial policy has been packaged with this pro-growth, pro-market deregulatory agenda as well. And I think there's some serious tensions, if not conflict, within the administration in terms of what they're trying to do.
That's industrial policy. Mr. Fastineau and Mr. Fletcher, I understand, also have some harsh words for so-called free market, free trade, which is what on our best days we think we practice. They claim that the manufacturing base is not growing. You identify very clearly that is a peculiarly narrow metric. How so?
Well, this is, again, the challenge with industrial policy. And it goes, and we quoted Adam Smith. There's another famous classical liberal named Frederick Bastiat who has this wonderful essay called The Seen and the Unseen. And he talks about how when it comes to public policy, specifically industrial policy, where you're focusing on a particular industry or a particular sector, it's easy to focus on what has happened in this sector. How can we improve this sector, improve employment, improve wages, expand it? But what's unseen, Bastiat argues, is all the costs and the alternatives, the roads not taken. And so the authors of this book and other advocates of industrial policy are very critical of quote unquote free markets, free trade regime of the last 30 years that they think has hollowed out important industries, whether it comes to chips or mining or heavy manufacturing. And again, the issue here is a conflation of many things. I think it's true, and it's worth asking the question why the U.S. does not manufacture a lot of high-end semiconductor chips. That's an important question. Or to look at why there's not a great deal of mining, or why electricity generation in the U.S. has not grown very much compared to some place like China. Those are fair questions, but the authors immediately go to, well, it's because we didn't have the right government policies and we had free trade, and that allowed these other cleverer countries to steal our industries from us, to subsidize, you know, national champion corporations. And so they were clever and we were foolish and had this free market dogma. And that's why this happened. I find that explanation completely uncompelling. If you actually study these areas, what you find is in the United States, we have a labyrinth of red tape. It's nearly impossible, or has been nearly impossible, to create a new mine in the last 20 years. Almost impossible. It has been extremely difficult. You talk about rare earth metals, the refining of rare earth metals. It's a difficult process. It involves technology. It involves some elements of waste and pollution. And we have become so stringent in the United States, both in our pursuit of various greenhouse gas emission reductions, as well as other kind of environmental goals as to make it impossible for business and private enterprise to do the kinds of things that industrial policy advocates think that we should do. And I think they have a decent case would be good and that the U.S. could do competitively. So, again, it's conflating, you know, with a wrong analysis of the problem, which leads them to believe that this industrial policy of putting money in particular, government money in particular sectors or favoring particular sectors or the tariffs, we didn't even talk about tariffs yet, are all these quote unquote solutions to the hollowing out or the deficiencies that are pointed to in the United States.
Let us speak of tariffs when we come back. I'm speaking to Paul Mueller, who's written for Civitas Outlook on a new book about industrial policy, recommending it for the United States by Mr. Fastenau and Mr. Fletcher. Paul helps me understand that this is an active argument. I'm an amateur reader, but an active argument in economic circles, which is very helpful because when we come back, we'll not only speak of tariffs, we'll speak of examples such as EVs. I'm John Batchelor.